Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today my guest is Barbara Gowdy. She's the author, most recently, of The Romantic, published by Metropolitan Books. But around a year ago or so, when Joy Williams was here — Joy Williams is one of my favorite writers — I'm always asking people, you know, what to read next. And she said, and there's a great new book called The White Bone. Well, when it was described to me, even by Joy, I said, no way that I want to be in the soul of a hunted African elephant. Until I started to read the book, and I actually found myself there and was kind of astonished by the intensities and poetry of the language there. Now, there's a huge distance between that book, The White Bone, and this new one, The Romantic, and I must think they define the poles or the spectrum of your sensibility.
I think they're probably a couple of corners, for sure. But there's kind of, you know, I don't write to theme, like I shall now write a book with this theme. It's only when I've done a book that I think I know what it's about. And I realize that in both books, I am dealing with memory and loss, certainly with the elephants, who probably have mnemonic perfect memories. That was a big part of The White Bone. But in this book, we know that one of the main characters, it's a memory. The book is actually a memory of a beloved who dies. And so the way the writer, I write this book, The Romantic, in the I point of view, the first person point of view. So the way this woman remembers her beloved is, of course, through her memory. And as I was writing it, I was certainly aware of how the memory is so fragile, and but without it, we don't have an identity. And I kept thinking about the idea of memory, as I had while I was writing The White Bone, and also how we survive loss, which is deeply in both these books.
Well, both books, in a way, have prelude paragraphs that are about the fixedness of memory, and in particular, one of the things that I like is the way in which the first paragraph tells us something truly scary about what happens. The past isn't fixed if it isn't dead. How are we supposed to preserve it? If it lives on in our memories, as we're always saying, then it can spoil. So in other words, keeping it alive too long makes it rot like food, and it's only when it's become stable, that is to say, somewhat embalmed and unalive, that we can count on it to be the same from one moment to the next.
We can count on it to be the same, but not accurate. We embalm our memories by repeating them, by telling the same story over and over to somebody, by telling the same story over and over in our head, but that makes us suspect, too. You know, when you're writing a fiction from the point of view of someone who's remembering, it's also such a suspect enterprise, because nobody remembers verbatim dialogue like your characters appear to, but we accept it as a convention of fiction, oddly. People think fiction is so naturalistic, but it's as unnatural in a way as you know, opera. We don't burst out into song when we're feeling passionate.
This narrator, Louise, tells her story from several juncture points in time, and I almost found myself thinking as I went along it was to keep the memory living, that to have a continuous memory would just be about chronology, that this is about finding nodal points of feeling or something like that, so that the memory will stay meaningful to her.
Nodal points of feeling, that's probably a good way of putting it, because we remember through feeling, I think, and through senses. And I think also that whenever you talk about, say, a house you lived in or a lover you had, that single memory has all sorts of sphere of implication that come up as well. And so you don't remember anything in isolation, although you pretend to. And I think that's why I move backwards and forwards in time, because I think that's how our minds work. In every moment, we are who we are, we are who we were, and we are who we hope to be or hope to be perceived as. And that's the constant present, I think. So I try to evoke that. Whether or not it works or not, I don't know, but that's, I think, what I was trying to evoke in working that way.
You know, it was interesting because I felt implicit in this book is an attempt to recapture a kind of love that is available in 1968 when the book is set and has become less acceptable or less available now. The love for a dangerous or a poetic or a useless person, which was, you know, flaring up in the 60s like no one's business. No one wanted to be with the person who was going to work for his father for the rest of his life, but with, you know, a failed poet or a druggy pianist or, you know, someone who knew odd things about the world that couldn't be put to use. This was a romantic figure of that period, and it seems as if the book in part is interested in reinvoking the possibilities of a different, a nobler or a less economic kind of romance.
I'm glad you said that, because he's not everyone's, you know, boyfriend of the month, and this girl Louise, who loves him exactly for the reason she said, in that it's not just the zeitgeist that determines it, but she loves how he lives in the moment and how he experiences the world constantly as a gifted child, I guess, which is he lets whatever sensation is present in. And I've been taken to task by certain critics for this character, saying, why would anyone love him? You just want to slap Louise for loving him. And I thought, it's not just... Yeah, it's not just that he's, you know, he's not going to be a great father one day or a great provider, but he's a little mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And on top of that, outside of this book and romance, I think there's a kind of zeitgeist in fiction where we want to have nice people have something bad happen to them and see if their niceness remains intact. And unlike Emma in Jane Austen or Anna Karenina, for God's sakes, you know, who just doesn't grow or learn anything, so she has to die under a train. We can't have very flawed characters who grow or don't grow in fiction without being, you know, having your knuckles wrapped, as I have had with this book.
Well, it's funny because I think, where are these critics' memories? This was the prototype of the romantic hero. You know, he didn't want to work. He wandered through fields. He had a relationship to nature that was both preternatural and a little scientific to illuminate it. There was something bright and brilliant and funny about him, and he was so much more interesting than other people. And that was the great poet guy of the 60s. And I remember that men and women fell for him.
I mean, still fall for them. Which might explain something.
Now, I'm interested. You say that there's that some things are not planned and that you know what things are about only afterwards, right?
When I'm writing.
When you're writing.
Yeah.
But I noticed something, for instance, that characterized the hero, whose name is Abel, short for Abelard, just as the heroine's name is Louise, sort of accidentally short for Heloise. And the first thing he shows her are the glinting eyes of a toad as it catches the light, and the pupils turn gold. Later, much later in the book, he's showing her the beetles. They go to a ravine and they're examining different kinds of scat. They're discovering the natural world, and she sees the glinting backs of beetles scurrying around these piles, these mounds, and, you know, glittering, glinting things. Now, is that not planned?
No. You know, I think I know I sound kind of disingenuous or like I'm planning to sound disingenuous in the interview, but I think I have a very mathematical, logical subconscious that I can depend on. And you know, I don't have a bottom drawer. Everything I've written has been published in the order I've written it from, and I don't have a notebook, and I don't get up in the middle of the night and write anything down. I don't even think about writing. I think about reading and I think about thinking, but I don't think about writing or what I'm working on till I sit at my desk. And it's a light going on that turns off when I get up from my desk. And so whatever is planned there. And I think because it happens in that enclosed space, I don't think too much beyond it. I mean, that's just how it works for me. Therefore, I can't also work on more than one thing at a time. I really envy writers who also are working on short stories and maybe have another novel started and are writing essays and book reviews. I always feel like I'm screwing around on my work if I do that. I have to focus on one thing. And I focus pretty deeply. I live alone in a very quiet, soundproof house. So there is nothing to distract me when I'm working. And I go into it, and I think I go into it with a kind of laser logic, and then I come out of it and can't kind of remember, you know, I turn it off. And I think in a way it works. I often use this metaphor when I was working, because I was a musician before I was a writer, that there's something I think when a musician sits down to extemporize, they just better hope that everything they've learned up to then will come out of their hands, you know. And that's how I work, I think.
I'm speaking to Barbara Gowdy, the author most recently of The Romantic, published by Metropolitan Books. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. It's fascinating because in the previous book, The White Bone, which in America is available in paperback from Picador, the book oddly begins with a family tree of elephants and glossary. And I was pretty sure that the glossary was called after the book was completed. But it is interesting, there are all of these words, expressions really, that the elephants have for things, and they're largely based on whether something is good to eat or not, or smells bad, or but it's kind of wonderful. As a book that emerged instinctually, mm-hmm. as the words for things were invented, it's thrilling. The idea of the writer sitting down, let me make an elephant glossary first.
No, that didn't happen. No, actually, the glossary, I had to keep track myself of the words they would use. In the narrative, the words are the words we would use. It's only when we're in an elephant's mind or an elephant is speaking that they use, like a snake is called a flow stick, for instance. And I had to keep track myself of what they used, you know. So, and also I had to keep track myself of the families. I mean, if you meet one elephant, unless it's in a zoo, you're meeting 15 to 30 to 100 elephants because they are social matriarchies. So I had to keep track. And then I had to keep track, because it's a quest book, of where they went. And the maps in this book I drew. And I was hoping, I can't draw to save my life, I was hoping that an artist would do a proper map. But they used my primitive maps in this book. And it was how I kept track, because that was a book really working unconsciously. I mean, I almost had to go into this trance-like state and think, you know, I am elephant. What would it be like to be that big, to have a sense of smell that sharp? What can't I take for granted? I mean, they don't have email. They don't see as clearly as we do, although they see more clearly than we think in dim light. So that book had to work sort of so at a state so kind of unconscious and unplanned that I just had charts as I was going along to ground me back in the real world.
Some of the things, there's a book of stories, We So Seldom Look on Love, in which one story is about a necrophiliac, and the book has as its epigraph a quote from a Frank O'Hara poem about how they need someone to love them, and we so rarely look on love. But the question seems to be, what would it be like to be in this other zone, mm-hmm. which is in a way like a seance? Can I reach the other side of another being? Is that what that silent house and that private life becomes like when you're composing?
I've been thinking recently that everything we do wrong as humans, everything that we do that is cruel and ungenerous and self-serving and destructive has to do with a lack of imagination. And from out of a lack of imagination comes a lack of empathy. And early on, you know, I wrote, well, not early on, but early on in my career, not in my chronological age, but I wrote We So Seldom Look on Love. And that came from the same idea that if you look at something long enough, if you look at it long enough and it becomes more familiar to you, then you become less fearful of it and you become more attached because you know it. And what might seem ugly can seem at least familiar, if not lovely. And I think it's because I am a little bit xenophobic and, and quick to judge, that my own personal challenge in this life is to open my heart more. And so my characters in my books are constantly about exploring lives that aren't mine. I'm not an autobiographical writer, although I use the name Louise a lot, and it's my middle name, and I don't know why I do that. But it's to explore lives that aren't my own and to see if I can get it right. It's an intellectual and also an emotional and also an artistic challenge to try and do that. And to, you know, break down the boundaries of my own fears. I've talked to men, you know, I'm always myself asking writers, fiction writers, why do you write? And a lot of men had said, well, you know, I started writing poetry because you could get laid. It's a good reason to start. I don't think it's a good reason to continue. And I was thinking, why did I start? And to quote Leonard Cohen, who said this, and I don't know if either of us really mean it, but it's just to find out who I am. Can I love a necrophile? Can I love, a murderer? Can I love and understand and love an elephant and enter lives, consciousnesses that aren't my own? Occasionally I do get it right because I'm told by people who are those people in the real world, you know, that was me.
Well, what you say has a real interest to me because that, to look at things carefully until they become loved, is what Louise learns from Abel. In your new book, The Romantic, published by Metropolitan Books. And I did feel peculiarly, a lot of this book has to do with someone with a destabilized sensibility, Louise, gazing at someone with an artistic sensibility. Louise's mother has left when she's real young, and she just doesn't come back. She just leaves. And Louise's model or impulse is, you know, hurt me and I'm gone in a certain way. And she does that with her loved one twice. She leaves, basically, and she can't imagine being with him during those times of her grief. Finally, he dies. We're told from the very first page of the book that now she is in the position, since he's gone, that she will look closely at these things. And the book seems to be about this woman, Louise, writing in a vein in which this man taught her to look at the world.
I hadn't thought of that. It makes me actually kind of emotional because I think it's true. I was involved with a... I don't write autobiographically, and this isn't someone I know, but I did live with an alcoholic who eventually drank himself to death, not in the same way Abel did. And I was also a different person I was involved with for a long time who taught me to look at the world and to love what I don't love and to accept that this is all there is, so why not love it? It's all there is. You can hate it, you can rail against it, or you can love it. And you know, the Zen way, I suppose, of looking at it. And the last way always seems the right way, but it's entirely against my nature, which is controlling and wanting to go to battle, you know. In my mind, I'm a Valkyrie, you know. In my life, I hide out in a room, don't wash my hair, and don't have a knife. But it's what I believe, though. You know, I believe that whether I follow it or in my own life, I do believe that we have to pay attention. We have to be curious. We have to look until what is abhorrent it becomes at least familiar. And I mean the worst sorts of things, too.
What I found was that this was a book about people who wanted their life to have a strange magic about it, who were and are, like most of us, condemned to ordinary life, and that otherwise, without these things, without his nocturnal walking, his mother who goes around the neighborhood yodeling after him even though he walks most nights, a world of eccentricity providing a hopeful entrance to a more fully magical world. And yet the writer, as well as the narrator, is condemned to describe this world in which there are so many disappointments, and the person who seemed magical gets called alcoholic, and the person who seemed entranced gets called codependent. Why don't we have a novel in which those naming words don't exist, and we watch as someone entranced follows someone magical? And that was what once seemed like the possibility of life. You know, if we go to fiction only for that, it feels like we're missing out on one of the essences of being so haunted by another person that you come to believe that there is a parallel world that that person could take you to, a much better, a much more thrilling, a much more exciting one, and that if an author is good enough, that world will exist in the book for the reader alongside this world. And that what seemed to me to be the power of this book, that it was enjoining the romantic on the reader who couldn't help but also see how sad and inadequate the real becomes in its wake.
Well, obviously, that's good for me to hear, and it is, I suppose, the whole poignancy of life, isn't it? And I was thinking as you were speaking, where are the magical moments? The magical moments are when we first fall in love, and then if it's powerful enough, it can sustain a lifetime of lifetime litany of love. But if it isn't, then we have to bring other things to bear to the relationship to hold on to it. Also, when a baby is born, but also when we die, he's close to death, and it brings him a kind of visionary look at things that not many people have talked about, but is rather important to me. I'm perfectly healthy now, but I was sick enough for a while that even while I wasn't close to death, I believed I was, and so it works just as well. And I was aware, you know, in the old poetic sense, that the world would go on without me, and how marvelous and tragic that was. But also, when you are no longer invested in the world, this is Abel's point of view in the book, when you are no longer invested in the world, you're not about to make a living or make babies or have a reputation of any sort. When you take yourself out of the equation, but you're still there enough to have perception, you see it. You finally see it. You see what is there to be seen, not what is there to be used or to hurt you or to be enjoyed by you. You just see what is. And that was his gift. And for all that he was a drinker and he was selfish and he couldn't keep his hands off other women because every woman entranced him, he had that marvelous gift of being able to see what is. And in my religiosity, that's everything. I'll forgive a whole lot for somebody. I'll forgive a whole lot in somebody who has that kind of vision, because that's where our poets and our saints and our visionaries come from. So I try to create a character not unlike that. I'm not like that, and I don't really know if I've known anyone like that, but in my 20s I believed I did.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, Louise, really her very powerful moments are moments of departure, when her mother leaves, when he leaves, and Abel doesn't call her from Vancouver, and ultimately when he dies, almost as if she comes into her own when what isn't there for her anymore.
When we divest ourselves, it's when we're thrown back onto ourselves, you know, and then we have to find out who we are. So, you know, that's why people have gone out into the desert and naked and to find out who they are. And in her case, it's all involuntary. She doesn't want her mother to leave. She doesn't want Abel to leave her or betray her or be forced to leave him, and she doesn't want him to die. But unfortunately, that's when, you know, we learn through pain, the horrible fact. And if we're going to learn at all, some of us learn nothing. But when there's you naked with nothing, and you feel no hope and nothing comforting in your memories and nothing to hope for, then you're just once again stuck with who you are. And you know, it's a big job, isn't it? Know thyself, find out who you are. And why I created a somewhat flawed character in Louise at the beginning is to see if she could find out who she was and to grow. And I think the other reason, you know, here I am explaining everything afterwards, but I think these are the conscious moments that came into my unconscious writing process. I present these people as children because then I hope that you're more invested in them and you can forgive them. I've always wondered why mothers of, you know, pedophilic mass murderers go to the trials, because they remember these people as children when they were little angels and they loved them. And they can forgive them even that. I also have in this book angels, you know, the angel of love thing. It's another I don't believe in a kind of new age angel thing going on, but I believe that there is a place, an angelic place in our minds, a pure place that we can arrive at through loving each other that we too often pollute by our behavior and our needy thoughts.
I've been talking with Barbara Gowdy, author most recently of The Romantic, published by Metropolitan Books. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
You can read the first chapter of The Romantic on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistants from Alan Howard, Mario Diaz, and Rob Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.